Tonight's topic is, can we survive the present economic system? And it's jumping off of this book, For the Common Good, that Al will introduce, that sounds really exciting and groundbreaking. The reason I know that is because I just read a review of it, even though I've never looked at the book. So anyway, I just want to, forums at Holden are a time for us to talk to each other. All day long you go to the teaching staff sessions and you hear teachers present their viewpoint. What we try to do at forums is to just generate conversation. The goal is not unanimity nor even consensus, but simply a lively conversation. And that's what we hope will happen here tonight. Just to say, the village, Holden Village, takes no official positions on anything, basically. I've never heard of one anyway. So if it seems that you're hearing a company line, challenge that. Nobody's here to push anything down your throat that you don't want to believe. And we're just here to converse with one another tonight and to try to get ideas out there in the mix. So we would really like to hear from you. The only ground rule that I understand for forums is that we will end promptly at 9:30. No matter what is going on, this forum will end at 9:30 officially, and I'll be timekeeper. And then if you want to continue the conversation, you can feel free to do that. And the other thing is that if the speakers go on and on too much, and then I'll tell them they have to stop so that we can hear from you. Al's going to begin, and then John, and then DeCane.
Good. Well, 2 or 3 months ago, Susan Tobias, an Episcopal priest who's an old friend of ours, brought this book up and gave it to me. So I felt I ought to read it or think about it at least. And I started to read it. It's by Herman Daly and John Cobb. Herman Daly was at Louisiana State. He's now at the World Bank. He's known for his steady state economics, and he's kind of anathema to all of the market economists. And John Cobb, who's a process theologian, who was just retired from Berkeley. And I would say that of all the books that I've begun to read and leafed through enough to know, I skimmed the whole last part today. This is probably number 2 book on your reading list. The number 1 book is The State of the World. I have to get this in. Everybody knows this is kind of a joke. This is the number 2 book. If you're serious about the state of the world, you got to read this and this. All right. And the reason we have this forum is because John McDonald got his PhD with Herman Daly. And here he is. So he knows everything that Daly knows and a little bit more.
Oh.
At any rate, it's my hypothesis. I suppose I had this hypothesis in the book. Simply reinforces it, that the principles of our economic system and the practice of our economic system and the ethos that's presupposed by our economic system will lead to the end of the habitable world for us unless something changes rapidly. The fundamental principle of the economic system is that if you get the interaction of self-initiations, self-instituted forces, economic activity, that the interaction, the market, which monitors the interaction, will bring about the best world you can have. They don't say it'll bring about a good world, but it'll bring about the best world you can have. The practice of the economic system, I would say, and I'll only use one illustration, leads to global warming. The economic system is highly dependent upon energy. It's dependent on fossil fuels. And we are using in this country about 25% of the fossil fuels in the world. And the carbon dioxide that is given off with the use of fossil fuels is creating a blanket. It's warming us. And whether you take the position it's leading to the ice age or to the inferno, in any case, the warming is taking place. The climate will change, the whole world will be different, and this economic system has no way of really taking that into account, qua economic system. It has to be taken into account outside the system. The fundamental ethos of the system I can summarize by quoting Thomas Hobbes. This is kind of archaic language. To consider them behind, that is to consider oneself ahead, is to consider them behind is glory. Just the opposite of what Dan Erlander was saying. Consider them before is humility. To fall on the sudden, that is to fall, to fail, is disposition to weep. To see another's fate in to see another fall is disposition to laugh. Continually to be outgone, outdone is misery. Continually to outgo, outdo, the next before is felicity. And to forsake this course is to die. And it seems to me that the whole economic system presupposes this focus on your domination, your success, your making it, your production, your role in the whole productive enterprise. For those reasons, it seems to me, we are in real trouble. And while you might say the culprit is us because of what we want, I think without a change in the principles, the philosophy of the economic system, without a change in the practice of the economic system, and without a change in the ethos that underlies the principles and the practice, we will within the next 100 years find life almost impossible on this earth. John, it's all yours.
We didn't plan any of this until today. And I guess the reason I'm sitting here is because I did do my PhD under Herman Daly, and I did it under Herman Daly on purpose. Just a little bit of background. I started out my professional career as a civil engineer with interest in environmental problems, and then found out that that was one slice of the environmental pie, and I was more interested in the whole one, and so anyhow, eventually wound up doing a PhD in economics. So I come to economics with a much different background than most economists have. It seems I'm going to probably dwell more on the theory of economics and a little bit on the practice of it that Al was talking about, but more on the theory. One of the key problems with our economic theory and the way it gets practiced, but is that we and maybe you view economics to whatever extent you understand it as a theory, view it sort of as a science. It's considered a social science. Most economists indeed view it as a science, or maybe even almost a hard science, because it is so mathematical. We have, economists, have very little understanding of the philosophy behind economics, the Hobbesian philosophy. Many economists think that we really have no philosophy, that it is a science. Without philosophy, we deal with facts, we deal with numbers, quantities, prices, changes, and those kinds of things. But in fact, we do have a philosophy. It is even a religion for some economists. And I gave a lecture just recently at Luther College that I'm sort of drawing on in my rambling right now. We do tend, and I say economists, not myself, but economists, tend to view economics, tend to practice economics actually as a religion. We have our own triune God that is known and worshipped by the true believers as freedom, individual freedom, efficiency, and the holy growth. And in that lecture that I gave, I titled the lecture Demythologizing Economics. And what I meant by demythologizing economics is that it is not a science per se or only, but it is indeed based on some very strong normative values: freedom, efficiency, and growth. Well hidden as normative values, but nonetheless those are three of the key normative values, and all three of those values can get us into the kind of trouble that Al mentioned. Efficiency sounds maybe like the most scientific of those three, and that's why I critiqued that one and explained it in this lecture. Efficiency, economists mean by efficiency the maximum production of goods and services for consumption by this present generation. Maximum production and therefore consumption of goods and services. Policies and economic systems and so on that are efficient are ones that produce the maximum amount of material, non-material, but not spiritual, goods and services. So our economic system, a market economy, that is, does an incredibly good job at doing exactly that, because that is one of its goals, to be efficient, that is, to produce the maximum amount of goods and services. We use the word efficiency, and then we start to forget what, in fact, it means. It sounds very scientific, but it's obviously a normative value, producing as many goods and services as we possibly can, given the restraints that we have, whatever resources are available, whatever technology we have, however much labor we have, however many hours we are willing to work. So one of the things that people like yourselves can do when debating our economic system, just when discussing it and when arguing against it, one of the things that you can do is to beware of those people who say, but if you want to do that way, that's not efficient. And sometimes that tends to put you in a corner, because efficiency, probably for most of us, is kind of like motherhood. Well, you don't want to be inefficient, do you? So you sort of backed into a corner. Well, all you have to do is remind yourself or remind them, but what do you mean by efficiency? What does that mean in simple economic terms? It means the maximum production of goods and services. And then you can say, fine, we don't want to be efficient. We have a different normative goal. Maybe sustainability would be a different normative goal. And that could be the goal of an economic system. It could be. It isn't. It isn't the goal of any system that I know of. Not a system of groups of people and individuals. But anyhow, remember that efficiency, if that's ever used as a stick to beat you over the head with, that what you want to do is not efficient, say, fine, we don't want to be efficient. We want to be sustaining. We want to be stewarding. I'll stop there.
Let me just throw out a question. How do you think we can handle the problem of the global warming with our present system?
My first response to that is I'm not well read in terms of global warming and how and what that problem all entails.
Well, but we have to really reduce our carbon dioxide emissions. How does the system deal with that need to reduce?
As you were saying, it requires more than our economic system. The economic system itself does not handle that well at all, because of the result of that, the global warming, the different kinds of sacrifices that would entail are not a part of the system. They're not something that's traded in the system. It's not a cost that appears in the system, particularly because it is a cost in the future, whether that's 10 years or 100 years in the future. It's something that, I'm not trying to say when this might happen, but anything that is in the future, whether it's a year from now or 100 years from now, is going to be discounted by our economic system. Whether it's a benefit or a cost, it gets discounted. It's not worth as much as some other cost right now, today, or some other benefit right now, today. So our economic system does not handle that well. Our economic system is us making decisions within the confines of a legal system. I view our economic system as not a free market, or not capitalism. I mean, it could be called resourcism, because people privately owned resources that go into our economic system too. So I call it, in the courses that I teach, I call it a legal market economy. One of the things that we need to do is change some of those legal parameters. And one of the key ones that Daly and other people argue for is putting some real strict legal limitations on the quantity of natural resources of all sorts of types that we allow ourselves to use. Rather than the way we do it, if we find a resource, it belongs to somebody, whether it's the government or some individual or some group of people, it belongs to them. And then they make the decision on how fast to use that or how fast not to use that. In other words, it's not up, you know, the next generation or two or three have no say in that. Whatever they get is whatever we leave over, whatever we haven't found some way of using, mining or pumping out or cutting down or whatever. So we are free in that sense to use resources as fast as we want to satisfy whatever desires we have. And the economic system functions on that. It could function on restricted use of resources, but either they are, you know, restricted, I sort of see two ways, you know, either individually we all decide to use less. I don't see that happening, you know, by human beings after the fall, I mean even before the fall. Or we can come together, however, those same individuals, and say, all right, I'm willing to vote this law in that says we'll only use so many tons of this and gallons of that and so on per year, because I know it's going to hurt me, but I know that it's going to hurt you too, that we're all going to be sharing in the hurt, in the pain. We're all going to be paying the cost. So reducing carbon dioxide emissions, one way to do that, first off, is to reduce our use of fossil fuels, and one way of doing that anyhow is to pass legal limitations on how much we can use. And there are ways of doing that that are really quite mechanically, administratively, are actually quite simple, fairly simple to do.
Thanks.
Do you see any inroads being made in the way that economics is being done? By like a greening of the economic systems, you know, that the green movement has made any influence in how people go about economic theory?
Not how we go about economic theory. I mean, you know, not much at all.
Not in this country, at least.
Yeah. And I can only speak for this country, as a matter of fact. I know a little bit about England, but not very much about economic theory that's been done. I was over there for a year, but I really just left economics behind and enjoyed doing other things for a year. So
way to go.
Dick Hain.
Two disclaimers. Anything I might say represents my own personal opinions and not necessarily those of Bread for the World. It's important to make that distinction because it's just important.
And you're from Luther College?
Second.
So they wouldn't expect that, would they? But, yeah. But they might with him. And so what he's saying is important.
Yeah. And second, I've got to say that since I was, Al Pitcher was my doctoral advisor, if I say anything wrong, Al, it's because you didn't teach me right. So you can't disagree with me. Basically, I have...
No wrong or right here, partly.
Yeah, right.
Partly.
Just a joke.
I
don't really have, I haven't done any lectures recently on this. Have been doing some work on trade policy, agricultural policy, food security, the right to food, private property and the right to food, a little bit of work on things like that, which are clearly related to the economic system and proposals by the United States to open up free markets worldwide and to reduce tariffs, subsidies to agriculture, and a lot of other things that are going on right now. Done a little bit of work on it. Don't know a whole lot about it. I guess I have two or three things to say. One is, in liberal theory, what I think you faulted, I'm not going to defend the economic system, no way. But in liberal theory, what you faulted the system for is not what it's designed to do anyhow. In liberal theory, it's the political system that is supposed to grasp the whatever it is that the economic system might do inappropriately and to make such changes as are necessary to redirect resources or to put legal limits. So I think most of the critiques laid against the economic system are not, in that sense, valid, because that's not what it would claim it's supposed to do anyhow. And then the question, if you go that way, is then why do we not have a political system adequate to direct our economic system? And then we'd be talking about politics and how economics in America influences politics, and how we're making global economic decisions and knitting global corporations without any global political power to direct the ends of all that and all that kind of mess. And so that's another just one thing to throw up for your discussion. I'm not going to go into it any more than that. Second thing I would say is just a comment about private property within the economic system. Now let me do a mini critique of one piece of the current economic system. Current economic system is fundamentally based on the right to private property. Now, there are some theorists who would say that private property is largely acquired by accident. You discover gold, you inherit something, you happen to be born on a certain piece of land. An awful lot of what goes into it is accident. And secondarily, that even the work you put on the land, the labor you put into mining the gold out or producing the crop or whatever it is, that labor itself is too, in part, accident. That is, you were born with a mind and a body that enabled you to do that. You were not born with the kind of, just at the most physical level, say, of farming a field, you were born with the physical capacities to do that. Not everyone is. It's not their fault they're not. It's not your fault that you are. And then you can apply that to a lot of other things, mental capacities, a whole bunch of things. So that a large part of the product of any labor, of any human activity, is fundamentally the result of accident. Now, if I have this much accident going and I own this field and you're starving to death over there, what right do I have to say that I own that field, that it is my grain, that I can charge whatever the market will bring, and you over there, through a series of other accidents, are in a position where you're going to die in the next day or two if you don't have that grain. And I think there are questions about private property, questions about what freedom means, so forth. So just throw that up in the air. And I guess a third comment. This is kind of hard for me. Let me put it to you this way. I don't know how many people are holding right now, about 200, round number. That's what I figured in Vespers, something like that. Figured 150, 160, close to 200, something like that. 200 people came to Holden Village on June the 1st, 1990, and they died that day. 200 people came to Holden Village on June the 2nd, 1990, and they died that day. 200 people came to Holden Village on June the 3rd of 1990, and they all died that day. 200 people came to Holden Village on June the 4th, and they all died that day. Sooner or later, somebody would begin to notice, I think, okay? And this continued, and this continued on June the 5th, 6th, 7th, and throughout the month of June, and every day for the month of July, and every day for the month of August, and every day for the month of September, and every day for the month of October, and November, and December, and by the end of the year, as many people died as will die today of hunger and hunger-related diseases. Their 100 years from now happened today. So I don't think the system works very well for them. But the way I angle into that is in terms of those people. So I'll throw that in too.
Just to make it a little simpler.
40,000.
40,000.
Yeah. I figured it out about 5 minutes before that.
That's what I've been reading.
In a round number. Now, I'm not saying that carbon dioxide isn't important. It is important. But 40,000 people are exhaling their last carbon dioxide today. And that's important, too. For them, they're real, live human beings, just as live as you or I. Just as real, with the same kind of dreams and hopes and visions, the wants, the needs, the fears, the anxieties. So, I don't think the system's working very well for them at all. Now, they don't all live under our economic system, so that's not entirely, I mean, that's a worldwide figure, that's not in the United States. But no system is working very well for them. So that's kind of dramatic. But doggone it, it's not any more dramatic than the reality. It's less dramatic than the reality. So let that start conversation then. I guess that's kind of a stopper. I really didn't mean it as a stopper, folks.
Howard, yeah, we want to hear from you. I feel as ignorant as I remember the one day one of our forum leaders was called on to lead a discussion on universal salvation, and he said he'd never thought about it, didn't really care about it, but he was happy to lead the forum and field questions and moderate the discussion. So I have no vested interest in this. I'll just take questioners. How's that? Or your response. Not so much questions to the panels as your responses among each other. Like, we should probably hear from a defender of capitalism, too.
If capitalism is as you say, do you propose that we revise it, or restrict it, or band-aid it, or do you have an alternative? And what is the church's proposal?
The only guard is politics.
All right. Then a follow-up question. Then are you suggesting that the capitalistic system is comfortable with a planned economy by the politician?
No.
I don't think any one of us is going to suggest that.
Are we proposing Christian socialism? What alternatives?
Or would one of you say at least what Daly and Cobb are proposing? I've been reading Larry's review here, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what their proposal is, and I think I get it a little bit. But
I know I can give Daly's position from his steady state economics book, not from this one, and so I'm not sure what it is.
Go ahead, give us the steady state.
Three institutional changes that Daly argued for in steady state economics and elsewhere. Three institutional changes. One has to do with controlling institutional change, and I'll explain what it could be like, that would control population, human population growth, control the use of natural resources, and the third one, distribution of the goodies that we produce, control the distribution. Controlling the population, he uses a plan that was devised by Kenneth Boulding, where each person is given a right to have a child, or however many, 1.1 children or whatever it would be, simply to sustain a
population.
Pardon
me, every person or a
person, individual person. Okay. And then these certificates or rights, whatever they would be, could be transferable. You could give them away to people as gifts, whatever. There could be a market for the exchange of them. In other words, he thinks that population control is so much of a problem that it requires a radical control of it, and that China does it by saying each couple can have one child. Well, he's saying each couple can have however many they want, as long as they have enough of these certificates. So that's one institutional change. Now, whether that then becomes Christian socialism or what, he's still a market. Matter of fact, there's be a market for those certificates. The second one, the distribution of the goodies, or he argues for limits on the maximum limit on income. And he said, I don't know what the number ought to be, but maybe a maximum limit and a minimum limit. And maybe the difference between the two ought to be a factor of 7 or 10. I mean, if the minimum level of income that we're going to allow anyone to live on, and we'll subsidize one way or another, if that's $10,000, then the maximum would be, if it's a factor of 10, would be $100,000. After that, if you earn income more than $100,000, it's taxed away at 100%. And the third one, on the controlling the use of resources, that's the one that I mentioned earlier. The way to do that is to that if someone wants to go out and buy, whether it's a company or an individual, wants to buy, you know, one of maybe 100 different basic resources, the first thing before you buy the resources, you have to buy a certificate, a depletion quota, a quota. In other words, there will be so many certificates that the government will control how many tons of coal should we be producing each year. Well, if it's 100 tons, then there will be 100 of these certificates out there of one unit each. First thing you have to do is buy that certificate, and then you go to the coal dealer, and the individuals don't have to do this. The first person who puts coal into the economic system, okay, goes to the coal dealer, says, I have a certificate, I want to buy a ton of coal. Fine, you buy a ton of coal, the coal dealer, miner, collects your certificate and has to, you know, give that back to the government to point out, sold a ton, here's the certificate. That can be done on maybe 50, 100, 200 of our most basic resources, and that's how we would limit the amount of resource use. The question is to determine, you know, how many tons we should use or how many gallons of this or that. But the first thing you need to do is get a certificate, and there are a limited number of certificates out there. So those three institutional changes is what he argued for.
I have a question on the tax bit. If the government taxes at 100% after the 100,000, do they then use the money for, how can we ascertain that they are going to be responsible for it? Are they going to be buying certificates to build houses for poorer people, or just what?
Well, that the minimum income that he argues for would be supported by that the tax on the maximum income.
So the lazy people need not work.
Well, you know, of course he's not going to argue that. You know, I mean, he's not, he you know, doesn't say exactly how we're going to develop this, you know, welfare system, what the penalties would be for people who simply will not work. I knowing Herman Daly, I think they say, if someone is able and is able to work and will not work, then they're not going to get any of this.
They're just going to die.
Minimum income. Yep.
My goodness.
If someone's willing to die, maybe that's the best thing for them.
That means their children die too.
Why do their children die?
Well, in other words, then we take care of their children. But if we're going to take care of their children, we almost have to take care of the parents.
Well, not necessarily.
We have to take care of their children.
No, I mean, I could see a system, you know, if the parents are unwilling to work, you see the children starving, take the children out of the home. Just like if you see them abused in any way, you take them out of the home. And the state, you know, finally has to make, the state has to make that decision. When do you take them out of the home from your responsible parents?
Does any, well, it sounds like this gets into the first person of the Trinity you were talking about, which would be freedom. Yeah. Because it sounds like every system being proposed obviously has less of a freedom quotient, or what we think of as freedom, than what we currently have. And of course, that's one of our points that we don't like to give up at all. Any responses here? Okay, Dan and then Dan.
Well, I was just thinking back on some of the stuff that Tom Simon was talking about in terms of part of the bankruptcy is not having a vision as part of the society for what we're actually creating this economic system for. And I was really struck by this spring by hearing a Native American woman speak from her perspective of what the cost of her Native American peoples has been of capitalist society. And she said one of the most important visionary tools that they use is something that she called the rule of seven generations. She said it operates differently according to different Native American groups use it differently. Some of them project seven generations down from, they look at the impact of any potential decision on seven generations down the line. Others of them use three generations behind, three generations in the future, and the generation that's currently there. But the idea is that every decision is inherently connected to the people who come before us and the people who come after us, as well as the people here. And that no decisions are made without looking at and taking into account how it will affect all of those people. And I just thought that was such a powerful way of recapturing vision for what this is all about, because so much of the economic fury seems to be visionless. It's so focused on the very, very short term, and then things like cost are only short-term cost and not long-term cost.
Daley's three institutional changes, by the way, are the three changes that he sees as necessary for a sustainable economic system. And he says, you know, in the book, look, I don't know if these are the three best ways of doing it, but here's, you know, let me just, you know, throw it out as sort of the auctioneer throwing out a first, you know, a starting price and say, okay, you know, have at it. I'm going to put it down in black and white, and now you can say Daley said that, and he's a jerk because this would happen, but we ought to do it this way. Because he's quite willing to come back and say, well, you're a jerk because it won't work that way.
But what it does is it shifts the parameters of the conversation away from, like, as you were saying, efficiency being the bottom line to sustainability being the bottom line. So then you're arguing about within a different framework.
Right.
Dan Cranford.
It seems to me like, I don't know too much about economics, but that it's such a monolithic thing that it's almost like the church, that it's almost impossible to make creative inroads in. People are dealing with something that's sort of cut out of granite or something, and that anything innovative or creative, you know, which kind of always leads me a little bit to look at what the Green Party suggests in terms of, like, when you talk about efficiency being the second whatever, the Trinity. You know, what about sustainability? What about simplifying lifestyles? I mean, we're living in an economic system that maintains lifestyles. You know, the second two-story home that maybe our parents had or some parents had or whatever. Maybe it's time we have to look at a new economic system that doesn't give us as much of what we don't need in the first place.
Well, there are all kinds of personal responses, but there are also institutional responses. And with personal without the institutional, I think, will not make it. So what Daley is suggesting, and there are many more in the book. There are nine chapters on change.
In this book.
Nine chapters, which I can go through and just, you know, give you the essence of. But the institutional changes are absolutely essential, along with the personal. I mean, you're talking attitudinal changes that are absolutely essential. They're one of the five keys for him are attitudinal changes.
But well, then you have to. How do institutions change?
Well, Toronto just accepted a program to limit the use of fossil fuels in Toronto by 20% by 1993. And the city did that. And so that political institutions can shift the parameters within which the economy works. Cities can make those kinds of decisions. They don't have to go to the whole state or even the nation.
Mm-hmm. Can I add just a sentence? Institutions change when we change them.
Yes.
Well, how do you do, how this sounds so much like
didn't
centralization.
Cut you off.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, excuse me, I should have let you speak then.
Is there a way to implement some of this without going so much on the centralized kind of scale, do more locally kind of, or?
The scale of the stuff we're up against here is kind of mind-boggling. Congress cuts $1 million to the left and to the right without blinking, folks. $1 billion,
well,
let's say.
We're going to appropriate $500 billion to go to Mars.
Yeah. The scale is mind-boggling. The,
another $500 billion for the savings and loan crisis.
1.4 million every day to El Salvador, for example. And while we need individual and cultural change and symbolic efforts and educational endeavors, we are up against a behemoth in the economic system. It's in our churches. Our churches reflect those values instead of counter them, by and large. My own life. If you've got any credit on your credit cards, you're in the system, folks. This is a very big deal. It's not that we can't do it, but micro efforts. Again, I have to say, I think part of the answer comes with politics. What has the power? What has the power
to harness IBM, AT&T, and whatever the names of some of the big grain companies are, I can never remember them.
Cargill.
Because otherwise, we're going to do our nice little micro things, and they're going to steamroller right by, and history's going to go on. We're going to be like, I was coming down the road, and a ground squirrel ran out. Oh no, I'm going to hit it. And I went right over it, and it stood there, and it looked around, and it ran off the road. But it didn't stop my car at all.
So do we surrender to pessimism?
No, no. It's the meaning of faith. Faith is not commitment to some abstract thing somewhere. Faith is believing that we together can change the system. That's what faith is. And hope is, you know, that there is a different kind of system possible. And love is uniting ourselves with the poor to do it. It's a redefinition of our theological vocabulary. That's Thursday of next week.
How about some of the rest of you? How about up in the balcony? Okay, Scott?
Yeah, I wonder if politics can even change what we're up against. You spoke earlier about the development of multinational corporations. It seems to me that they have discovered a way to be beyond the politics that we're involved in, because they have these blobs of capital that they can move around, and so we are no longer accountable to, or they are no longer accountable to, the kind of political institutions that you and I participate in. They create and form companies all over the world in favorable political environments and influence those environments. So it seems to me that we have to search for solutions. As I reflect on that issue, I'm forced back again and again to the people who are making decisions within those institutions. And that's a kind of an interesting thought, because those people show up here and there, and we know them. We are them, to a certain extent, and I don't know quite how. But I get discouraged when I think about influencing them politically, and more encouraged when I think about influencing them personally. The construction of the ship that spilled all the oil in Valdez, was what that was going to look like, was probably made by someone within Exxon International at some point, an engineer who graduated from one of our institutions and found his or her way up the company ladder, and they put together a team of people who designed that. People who administrated that set up the standards and the manuals and so forth for the operation of that ship for ordinary folks like you and I. But Exxon International can function anywhere in the world. I don't think Bush has much to do with them. I don't think Congress probably has less to do with them. What do you think? I mean, is that true, or?
Well, they function within at least somewhat within a legal system. So there's some of that kind of control over them. And then, I mean, as you point out, there's the personal contact too. It certainly isn't laws in are not going to be changed by just by, or maybe even by, the little people of us. It's probably the people, you know, the big shots that work for Exxon and whomever, that if those people have their vision changed, then you know, I mean, getting the institutional changes that Daley talks about, he says, you know, he doesn't see that happening in his lifetime. He doesn't see any one of those institutional changes happening in his lifetime, because it's going to take time for people's attitudes to change by the church, by discussions like this one at Holden, and including those who wield the most political power, whether they be executives at Exxon or wherever.
But the big people, we're all little people, and I can agree with Scott that you can influence your children and your grandchildren, and then we're talking about a generation rather than a longer space.
Well, I think we have two problems. One is an analysis of what the issue is. And I think that this Daley book gives you an analysis, and a whole lot of things that you think ought to happen, they think ought to happen, which are institutional and personal. I mean, their attitudes are very important. Religious faith is very important. The last chapter is on the religious vision. But that's first. And if you don't have that, if you don't read these two books, if you don't have that stuff in you, then you're not prepared to deal with the modern world, in my judgment. You're not really prepared. Now, the first thing you've got to do is get it in you. And then, you think, with Dick, how are you going to deal with 1.2 billion people who are hungry tonight? You at least have to know that it's there, and you have to know that a fifth of our people, of our kids, are in poverty here. You have to know that, and you have to know it enough so it becomes a little real for you. And then you can think about institutional change and personal change. You know, I differ. You know, I think you ought to start using handkerchiefs instead of Kleenex. I believe in these little things. And you stop eating meat. I mean, you stop eating beef that takes 15 times as much fossil fuel to grow it. I mean, to produce it. You just stop. If you get this stuff in you, you will stop, I think, if you really get it in you. Then we got to go to, you got to take some analysis like this. You either got to say yes or no, or it's the right direction, and you got to start doing the kind of thing that Dick, I'm sure, is going to be talking about all week. You got to start working on the powers that be to bring about some institutional change. And it's both intellectual. We have to educate our people. We have to re-educate our people. We have to re-educate everybody is teaching economics in this country. And we have to start teaching economics in a different way in this country. The universities have to change. I think our society is dysfunctional and our educational system is dysfunctional. I see no way to function in the present system except to say no to most of what it's about. Most of what it's about. Now, half of me wants to work in that direction. The other half of me wants to start a new community. 3,000 people, separate from this world, generally speaking, you know, self-sufficient community. They talk about in this book, we're going to go back, we're going to get out of the city some. The Green Party leaders in Germany, you talk, try something that has some relevance for the future. Nothing, really nothing that we're doing now has any relevance for the third world or the future, really. Nothing in our lifestyle is really important for the third world or for 50 years from now in this country. We've got to do things differently. So that suggests that we try to do it differently. And then, of course, Dick will come right back and say, 40,000 people died while you tried to do it differently. And there you're caught. I'd like to be two people. I don't see any way out of that dilemma.
I don't mean to put the micro stuff down. What I worry about, I mean, it is important. That's how cultural change happens over time. Long-term transformation happens over time. What I worry about is, I mean, I've been around too many people who spent all of their time trying to get their own life cleaned up. And they've been eating tofu for 10 years. They haven't even eaten meat for 10 years. They read all the health magazines. And so they know that butter is in, no butter is out. You know, olive oil is in, no olive oil's out. And they're good people.
Canola oil.
Yeah. Okay.
Coffee is good.
And they're good people. Yeah. They don't drink coffee. They, you know, one of them, I'm talking about one specific person, I wouldn't dare name them because they're wonderful, lovely people and I love them dearly. One of them has a blood cholesterol of 110. They eat so low on the food chain. His blood cholesterol is 110. I told a nurse that. She said she didn't think that was possible. Now, that's great. And it's a symbol. And I learned from them. And that's wonderful. And that's good. And then, you know, and it spreads out and so forth. But another story that I was going to save for my own session, but I'll blow it now. So a guy goes to my church about 2 months ago. He works for one of the senators. He sings in the choir. Service ended, he crossed himself, he sang. A bunch of people in the choir went to lunch. He said, "I gotta leave early." They said, "Oh, stick around." He said, "No, I gotta go back to work." And they said, "Why?" He says, "Well," he says, "I got to cut $500 million out of the military budget this afternoon." I mean, just like that. You know, I don't do that much in a whole lifetime, you know. $500 million one afternoon. Now, Senator Nunn has to want that to happen. I mean, the aide doesn't make this up by himself. But that's the scale on which some of this stuff works. And
but
so
Dick,
is that we need to pay some attention to the political. Most people are so much into the individual that they ignore the political, and the political is where a lot of big stuff happens. So I'm not saying the individual's bad or wrong. I tend to come on strong on the political, though.
All right, well, we got 10 minutes left. I'd like to hear from some of you. Maybe you feel as lost in the realm of economics as I do, but you sort of generally disagree with the economic system or feel like there's something really wrong. How are you going to bring about change? More at what scale? What are you going to do? What are you interested in? I get that most of us think there's big problems. Since we haven't heard from Kent yet, we'll assume that.
I've been waiting for him.
I have membership brochures here.
I can just, you know, from a very personal standpoint, say I know what I need to do and what I'm trying to do, although I feel almost hopeless about it. And that is to get out.
Speak a little louder.
I need to get out of my investment in the system, which is debt. And I really have a struggle with wanting to have the things. I mean, I'm a graduate student, and I interrupted one career to try to start one that was more satisfying, and I've gotten to the age of 53 with no certain prospects ahead of me and a lot of debt. I invested in my education by getting government loans. I mean, talk about buying into the system. I'm in it, you know, up to my eyeballs. And I don't know how to get out of that. But I can see that that's a real good goal for me. And I don't know how that helps anybody else, but if I don't get out of it, I can't really help anybody else. That's no answer.
I'm not sure what the problem is going into debt for your education, whether it's a government loan or, private
loan. Also into debt for my teeth, and I'm also into debt for buying those things, like a trip to see my daughters that, you know, my teaching assistantship income wouldn't cover. And you know, little by little, I justify spending a little bit more than I have until I'm over what I can't live on.
But a graduate student should be in debt. I mean, I can't imagine a graduate student not being in debt.
Okay.
should the federal government be $1 trillion in debt?
That's a different question.
Yeah, I got to say, Dick, I'm looking forward to your sessions this week because I need to get, somehow the savings and loan crisis for me personally has really disillusioned me in the political system. To hear that Senator Cranston accepted, I mean, that to hear that Democrats would actually do these terrible things. And then to, you know, to hear that Paul Simon, who I know from up here, who's been at Holden, who's a great Lutheran, that he would vote to make Jerusalem the capital of Israel and stuff. I mean, the sick votes that are happening in Congress and the lobbying. I mean, is it, so I have to go to your stuff, get fired up again for the political process, but I'm not convinced with you that that's where my major effort necessarily needs to be. But you'll be here for 2 weeks, so maybe at the end I'll be really fired up. But what about the local changer? I don't know. What do some of you think? I'd like to hear from more women, too. I think, because, okay, women are scared of economics a lot. Jane Ross.
Well, a couple reactions. One, talking about institutional change, it, like Barb, it we're discouraged because it usually doesn't work. One of the reasons I was really nervous to come up here and be on teaching staff is because I thought after all my years in Africa, I should be able to say somehow, this is what Africa needs. But I don't have a clue. Things are bad in Africa and getting worse. And even people that have access to change the system, that are very concerned, really want the best. It gets worse. It keeps getting worse. And so that's why a lot of us finally say, in the end, the only level on which we can make a difference is in a few people's lives, our own lives and those with whom we're close.
Did you have another comment? You said you wanted to make a few comments. Okay. Lonnie, let's hear from Lonnie.
Oh, I do.
Oh, okay.
This is totally different. I just remembered it.
The other thing is, what about working sort of within the system? I mean, we're talking about Exxon and all these other people as, you know, these bad institutions. How can we influence their leaders? Well, for those of us kind of making vocational changes and choices, what about getting into that? Is that an ethical Christian vocation to be an engineer at one of these big companies? Or should we always be on the outside trying to influence somehow?
You're not going to get to top for 20, 30 years, and I don't think we got 20 or 30 years, to tell you the truth. What I'm reading says you don't have it.
Lonnie?
I remember years ago when I went to college, I took a course in economics, and the professor down at Gustavus talked about economics as being the dismal science. It seems to me it's gotten more dismal.
All right.
Well, we better get an undismal. You know, it's key.
Just the reason it was originally called the dismal science is because its theory was that the human population was growing faster than our food production was growing. In 1700s, I guess it would have been. I can't give you some. But anyhow, and it's interesting. Economics should be more of a dismal science than it is, because economics doesn't see any problems at all with food production or any other kind of production. So it could become dismal in its previous way of you know, capturing or being labeled that, and it would be a healthy move for. But I know what you mean.
Just a couple thoughts about the corporation. I tend to think we think of corporations as that phantom, the corporation. When in reality, the corporations that I know are run by men and women who care, who bleed, or are concerned. Mm-hmm. I know of a corporate president who runs a major utility in the United States and is vitally concerned about the fossil fuel issue. Another corporate president who has 370 long-term care facilities, and he is pained daily about the cost of providing care, you know, to those people. And so I guess I'd kind of step back and suggest that there are a lot of very concerned people working within the system, working within the structure. And I think for the person who made the comment about, you know, do we work within or do we work without? I would like to encourage working within. Because if we choose to work without, what do we replace it with? And I don't think anybody's come up with an answer to that that makes any sense to me.
Okay, we have about 2 or 1 minutes left here. Who would anybody like to have the last word? Anybody here?
I'll say a tiny hopeful word on, you know, the things you said about politics are all true. I also know that some of our staff went down to some aides who were thinking about some provisions for third world debt, what U.S. was going to do about third world debt. And we suggested that they put in the word sustainable development. We would like renewable. We think that's a better word, that sustainable development. Why didn't they just add into the criteria for U.S. loans dealing with third world countries? And the committee aides looked at it and said, yeah, that seems like a good idea. And bang, there it is. Public policy. Now, the Congress hasn't voted on the bill yet, and this and that. It may get dropped again. But, I mean, sometimes you work your buns off, and sometimes you just slide them right in. And it's amazing. And you know, all those people out there are going to have to prove that their projects are going to be sustainable.
I'd like to add just one more thing, and it's from my reading. I've begun to read Tom Sine's Mustard Seed Conspiracy, and one of the things that he points out is that we mustn't, as Christians, forget about God, and that it's God's intention to have a beautiful world, and that we can argue and figure and analyze all that we want and get confused and depressed and oppressed and everything else, but or maybe even come up with some wonderful ideas, but we got to acknowledge that God is able to break through, to break in, to change things in ways that we can't even begin to imagine. So we need to, one of the things at least we need to do is to be consciously opening ourselves to that breaking in that He might want to do.
Just to add to that note, we saw Eyes on the Prize, a long series about the racial struggle in the United States, and just to see years later Martin Luther King saying that, you know, he's been to the mountaintop and he's looked over. It just seems to me that maybe economics will get a Martin Luther King someday who will have a better vision.
Well, we need to stop here, but the conversation can continue. It's a good practice to end the forum season on time here. The book is in the library. This is the library copy, Holden Library copy. It does sound like a great book. Larry Rasmussen's review, if you want to just read the 3-page version, is in the May 14th issue of Christianity in Crisis, and I'm sure any of these panelists would be happy to talk with you at length. Thanks, everybody.